Hello and welcome to Tigers by the Fire, a podcast out of Holy Cross High School about World War II discussions and stories. Today is episode 5, and we will be talking about the Battle of El Alamein. With me are Jaden Davis.
How y'all doing?
Blade Schneider.
Hi.
And Cody Miller.
Hello there.
And today the guys are going to be talking about the I guess, first and second battles of El Alamein. And for those of you who don't know, this is going to be the battle over North Africa, focusing primarily on the Italian, German versus British side of the African campaign. So we're not really talking, I don't think, about Americans too much or at all.
Nope.
So no Patton, sorry. But there is a lot of Bernard Montgomery. So that's always something. So Coach Stu, our economics teacher, will be very happy about that. So I'm actually going to turn it over to Blade, who's going to kind of set us up with the context of this, and it's one of the most important events of the war and really culminates in the Nazi pushback. So Blade, lead us off.
So the context starts in 1940 because Mussolini is looking at North Africa and wanting territories. He wants to try to recreate the Roman Empire, so he wants more land, and he believes that invading Egypt is an easy target for multiple reasons, one of which is that he has a lot of territories that he's already taken already, like Libya, Ethiopia, and Somaliland, which gives him a good jumping off point. He surrounds the British, which gives him the ability to fight a two-front war to his advantage. Mussolini appointed General Rodolfo Graziani to lead the offensive in Egypt, except he was very hesitant at first because most of his equipment, which included planes, tanks, anti-tank gear, and mines, were outdated, and a lot of the Italians had to scavenge mines from the British side, and they had to find them, disarm them, and then rearm and place them on their own side to create their own minefield. He was also lacking transport for his troops, which made it harder to maneuver them around. However, Mussolini made him go through with it anyway, and in September of 1940, he launched the first offensive into Egypt. But the British did a good job of pushing them back, which forced the Germans to come in to support the Italians because they wanted this to succeed in order for the Suez Canal to get captured, which would have cut off the British from a lot of the supplies they would have gotten from their colonial holdings.
Yeah, and to your point, Blade, this is really about Mussolini wanting that expansion of territory. We saw that with Ethiopia in the 30s, and now he's thinking he can link up that northeastern African corridor, and he can go from Ethiopia on up to Egypt. But going across North Africa, and you brought up a good point, he doesn't have the mechanized forces that are needed to traverse that terrain as quickly as he needed to, and so the British are able to reinforce using soldiers from all over their empire, to be honest, to help protect that, and they're able to kind of resist them and push back the Italians. But this is going to be something that Hitler really wants as well. The idea of taking away the Suez takes away British resupplies through the Mediterranean and would cause them to have to go all the way around Africa getting supplies from India. So, no, that's a great point. No,
supplies are going to be a constant factor, especially for the Axis, because it's going to be a running theme that the Axis are short in some way on supplies.
And especially when you consider when this is taking place, right? This is on the heels of the takeover of France. And so Germany doesn't have the supplies it needs to necessarily wage a war in Africa. And then when we get to the 1941-42 part of this, I mean, Germany is fighting a war of wars in Russia. And so Africa is going to get kind of the leftover material. And so you're right. This is always going to be a shortage of supplies for the Axis, while the British this is going to be their one big focal point in 42 and 43. So very good. Cody, take us off.
So my big part that I worked on was talking about like the strategies that went behind the battle. And if most people would know, but strategies are pretty much what decide a war, because brute strength wouldn't be enough to kind of decide a war entirely. So some of the strategies I talked about was one that Blade led me into when he talked about the Italian offensive starting and the British fought back. This was through an operation called Operation Compass. Now, Operation Compass was started in late 1940 and ran until about 1940, early February. This operation was created by pretty much the Australian Army Corps, which was a ally to the British during this time, and it was pretty much a tactic that used very small mechanized forces that were adapted by General Richard O'Connor, who was a British general. I'm going to go into a little bit of info for him, so for people who do not know who Richard O'Connor was. He was a British Army officer who fought during both World War I and World War II, so he had plenty of wartime experience underneath his belt. During this campaign, he would push back the large Italian army, which consisted of 80,000 troops, with his much smaller 30,000 soldiers. The reason why this tactic worked was because of the British's superior number of heavily armored tanks, which outnumbered the Italians 275 to about 120. And about 50 of these tanks were heavily armored Matilda 2s, which I will go into more detail later on, and which proved to be too much for the Italians' anti-tank and heavy armor weaponry. These tanks were a big push force because with the tanks, they were able to push back the army and stop the Italians from pretty much making any big moves into Egypt and Africa. This strategy resulted in about 3,000 Italians killed and about 130 captured. So this showed that just how he was able to, through these good tactics, he was able to push back a massive offensive, which he was very much outnumbered when he outmanned. But as I said, he had the heavily armored advantage to this. Now, another strategy that the British employed, which was not really much of a strategy as was a holding, was the Qattara Depression. Now, this was an area in northeastern Egypt that consisted of salt lakes, marshes, and other difficult terrain. Now, the reason why this was such a big factor is because these armies with their heavily armored vehicles, like their tanks, weren't able to move across it very easily. And
also, I wanted to interject a little bit to that point about the conditions and the terrain. So, one thing that's like not really talked about or mentioned a lot in most like conversations about the African campaign is how hot it was. So like, if anyone's ever like worked outside in the heat, 80 degrees or even 90 for like at least 20 minutes, you can know that like takes a lot out of you. And just imagine that type of heat, but like times 100 in the North African campaign. So in the North African campaign, of course, there's a desert, so there's little to no shade at all. And this proved very difficult for the soldiers, especially with like the white rocks and white sand, which basically reflected all sort of heat back onto the soldiers. So this caused for everything to be hot, the soldiers to be hot, the cars, the mechanized units to be overheating, as well as the guns. It got to a point to where like any sort of like metal or exposed metal actually like would burn soldiers' hands. And Coria Barnett's book, The Battle of El Alamein, The Decision in the Desert, does a really good job of like describing how bad these conditions were, and specifically the lack of resources, talking about the water. So the only like source of water that the troops actually had was from a miles of pipeline, which basically was like there was no water nearby, so they had to rely on these pipelines to get all these water sources. And the worst part about the pipelines is that when the water got to them, one, it was brackish, so it was just not good drinking water, and then second of all, it was warm, so it's like you're thirsty and you're just like finished fighting and digging foxholes, but now you have to drink hot water. And so which was like really like detrimental to like soldiers' morale. But beyond that point, each soldier was given a gallon of water per day, in which they had to do things such as cook, shave, drink it, cool down the radiation for radiators for the vehicles, and of course drink it. And so this is one of like the major like points of the battle, which like determined like how well the soldiers fought, which is one like the heat of the battle, this situation, as well as just like not having access to like clean drinking water, which led to just low morale overall.
Yeah, and that impacts everything. The soldiers' ability to move around in particular. There are accounts, I want to say in the Miller book, where they talk about the rubber on soldiers' shoes like melting, right? And their shoes are essentially going to be scrapped because of that. And then, like you said, the vehicles overheating was a big deal. And you said something that caused me to think too. You talk about the soldier outside. What about the tank crews? Like the tanks inside naturally are super hot, you know, 50 degrees hotter than it would be outside. Magnify that by 110 degree temperature with a sun that doesn't cease, no shade, everything else. And so, yeah, these soldiers are exposed to the elements and they have to go through a lot. And that definitely slows down any push that the Germans or the Italians are going to have.
And we had watched a episode of a documentary on Amazon Prime called World War II Battles in Color, and there was an episode dedicated to El Alamein. And at one point, he says that the tanks and the armored vehicles that they were in pretty much became kind of like hot boxes, and they weren't really allowed, and it made them trouble to breathe. And that's why some like tank pilots became some of like the most like severe, because like these pilots were pretty much these operators were pretty much exposed to like these, as you said, 112 degree temperature, and they weren't really allowed to, and they really couldn't breathe in it. So I feel like that's something that people had to take into consideration when talking about the extreme conditions that these people had to go through. Now, something else that I think is really important when it comes to talking about the defensive aspect of this battle was an area called the Devil's Garden. Now, the Devil's Garden was a name for a defensive area of minefields and barbed wire that was placed from the Mediterranean coast to the Qatar Depression in Egypt. Now, the person behind this idea was the German field commander Erwin Rommel, or the Desert Fox, as some people have heard him be. Now, Erwin Rommel realized that with his supplies dwindling and the British taking advantage of that, he couldn't engage in a frontward battle with the British, so he decided to make a defensive barrier to pretty much stop the British offensives moving forward.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, Kurt, I keep interjecting.
No, you're fine.
But also want to talk a little bit more about like Rommel, specifically like his reputation on the battlefield. Yeah. So Donald L. Miller's book does a really good job of, or gives like a few accounts from different people about Rommel, specifically from a Swedish journalist called Arvid Fredberg, and he says the fall of Tobruk made an enormous impression on Berlin and throughout Germany. Public spirits rose at a peak, at once to a peak not experienced since the conclusion of the Battle of France in 1940. Rommel was the man of the day whom nothing seemed impossible. And these like sentiments about Rommel wasn't just about like stop at the people of Germany. It actually like led all the way to the soldiers. So when Rommel got to the battlefield, especially in the North Africa campaign, the soldiers like trusted him wholeheartedly. His reputation preceded him, and like they were ready to die or fight for this man. But this also kind of works like as a double-edged sword for the British military. They also knew of Rommel's like superiority in the battlefield. So you see a lot of accounts of him almost being deified by the British soldiers, and this stroke fear in the British soldiers' hearts with sort of like a defeatist attitude at some points, especially with like all the certain conditions that they were going through, that like how can we defeat a guy like Rommel, the Desert Fox. And beyond that, also since we're like on the talk of generals, we can also talk about General Montgomery, which was across many accounts beyond like the Miller book, but like in every account that you hear of Montgomery, he is not very well liked. The people describe him as being arrogant, overconfident, and like nobody really likes him. But while this was like a big issue, especially when he first got to Cairo, this also kind of worked for his benefit. So when he first got to Cairo, the first like 2 days when he was there, he spent the time walking around the battlefield, and any soldier he met, he just talked to him. He built like a personal connection with the soldiers, and his confidence in himself as well as his battlefield capabilities really helped him build like these personal connections with these soldiers, which put a new like era across like the soldiers themselves. A lot of people like stop feeling a defeatist attitude and more like a happier, I guess, if you can say happier attitude with a personal relationship being built between the generals. So I just wanted to add that a little bit.
Yeah, and he gets a weird reputation, I think, historically, and a lot of Americans and British tend to look at him a lot more positively than they do other German generals like Hans Guderian or anyone like that. They tend to give him a little bit more respect, and they look at what he did in Africa, and they tend to admire it for a lot of different reasons, which I always find kind of interesting. And also Americans had the same thing. I mean, he's the one who, when they first get into North Africa, they face Rommel, and he absolutely destroys them. Battle of Kasserine Pass and these events. And eventually, obviously, he's defeated. But he definitely has this reputation as a soldier's general, as someone who is formidable. And I think because he dies, in the war in 1944, and he's kind of forced to kill himself with Hitler after the assassination attempt. He like gets looked at as like the good Nazi. It's kind of weird. He's also not in the Russian campaign. He's here, so that's a lot different too. So I think that also makes it different. He's not in the areas where they have the most atrocities, and then he's in Normandy in 44. So very interesting character. And Montgomery, like you said, Montgomery is so interesting. If you have a room full of 70 and 80 year old men from America, they all hate Bernard Montgomery. And he's just got that reputation as being kind of arrogant, the most British of British people, I guess you could say. And even Churchill is not known for his humble nature, thought that he was an insufferable, arrogant jerk sometimes. So, but very talented, both of them very good generals, and Montgomery is the best the British have.
Something I wanted to add to what Jane said was the whole confidence thing. One of the important things is that Montgomery instilled a lot of confidence into his soldiers after they'd been beaten back a little and when he arrived. And a lot of that was because he assured them that they were going to win. He went around and saying and outright said, "We are not going to retreat," which built up a lot of confidence that the British could pull off a successful defense and counterattack.
Yeah, he boosts the morale when they needed it, when everything has been pushing back, and he comes in and says, "Nope, this is where we're going to stand, and then we're going to win." And he had zero, at least publicly. Who knows privately what he's thinking, right? But publicly, he is outward in the fact that they're going to win, and he's very confident about it. And that confidence is going to be shown through his soldiers. Now, that's a very good point.
Now, getting back to the topic of the Devil's Garden, a bit of statistics. The historians estimate that a total of 3 million mines were laid in this garden, and I know that's a very large number, and they used this as pretty much a big like barrier to hold back the British offensive with their tanks, because if the tank was to roll over one of these mines, it would explode and then take down the tank. So it was pretty much like one big like way to stop the offensive with these much stronger tanks. And not really a fun fact, but kind of a fact for you, that most of these mines that were laid during this offensive with the garden are still there today. So a lot of these mines are still active and still present in the area today, and which has made that area very dangerous to go into because of the risk of those mines. So to advance into the territory that was being held off by the Devil's Garden, the British employed a strategy where they would make trenches in the sand and they would move their tanks deeper into the area. But to find where the mines were, they employed sappers to detect and uncover the mines. Now, a little bit of information on what a sapper was. A sapper was a British soldier who would be given the task of sweeping the ground in front to find the mines figure out this is where one is. We have to dig the trench away from this one to pretty much avoid. And it was made to figure out a way to move the tanks through. Now, moving the tanks through this trench was a very slow process, because you would expect a tank is not very fast when it comes to this. Well, some of them weren't. And they had to do it in small intervals as to not be ambushed by the German air vehicles that were holding air superiority.
Yeah. But I also want to provide like a little account from the sappers. So one like kind of interesting fact about the sappers is that most of the time they didn't have guns. They were only held with bayonets, which they had to use to like figure out where the mines were and then destroy them. So and most of the time they went out at night. So like that also adds like another layer of like complexity to the sapper unit. So I have a really nice account from John F. Matthews, who details a firefight that he had with a sapper unit. So it goes, "In the distance, we spotted what appeared to be some rolls of 44-gallon drums. These were strewn all over the desert and had been used to bring up water in previous battles. However, we were mistaken, as a supposed barrels turned out to be a mixed German and Italian patrol. Afterwards, estimated at about 50 to 60 strong. We were 14 strong, including the officer, myself, a sergeant, a corporal, and the rest privates. The officer and his batman went forward and I stayed with the sergeant. They were shot almost immediately. The sergeant then got shouted, 'Get out of get up and out of get up and get at them, boys.' But I had no arms apart from my bayonet, so I stayed down, as did a private next to me who had been shot through the hand and wrist. The sergeant, who I think by this time had been shot, uh, been been hit, shouted, "Get out, boys. Get out of it, boys." The enemy shouted, "Surrender." As far as I can remember, there was only the private next to me and I who got up and ran, being followed by tracer bullets. The next morning, at first light, a white gun carrier went out into the no man's land and found the rest of the patrol. There were no other survivors. The sergeant was found wired of the outer minefield with another private on his back, but both were dead. So 12 good men died that night. And I just really thought that was like a special account from a sapper unit, and to really just show like how intense these fighting, like these like small pocket fighting units were, as well as how integral they were to like the war effort for the battle effort.
Yeah, and it shows you just, you know, what these battles are too. It's these small individual moments where, like you said in that quote, you have 10 good men dying just for that whole night of action, and they have that really hard job of crawling out there and trying to remove the mines to save other people's lives. And so that's a great account that you pulled in there.
And the thing about the sappers is that a lot of them didn't make it out alive, because when they were tracing for the mines, some of them set them off and they were killed in the act of trying to clear those mines. And the operation that involved the sappers was codenamed Operation Lightfoot, which consisted of creating two channels that would allow for divisions of tanks and soldiers to move through the minefield and towards the German holdings. And now I'm going to pass it on to my co-host Blade for a segment on Malta.
As I already mentioned, the Axis were incredibly limited on their supplies for all of the North African campaign. And a lot of this was due to the fact that their supply lines were vulnerable. Rommel's supply lines and had to be shipped in from somewhere else. They would land at Tripoli and then be drove out all the way to the front, which left them vulnerable to being strafed by aircraft for most of the way due to the fact that there was no cover in the desert for anything transporting supplies. So if there was an airfield that was relatively nearby, it would allow the Allies to basically constantly harass Rommel's supply lines. And they conveniently did in the form of Malta, which was a small island off the coast of Sicily that was controlled by the British. Malta had a couple airfields in it. And what would happen was that they would routinely send planes out to go destroy anything sending supplies to Rommel, which would routinely deprive him of supplies. A good number to illustrate this is Rommel had requested 30,000 tons of supplies a month, and on average he got about 6,000 tons of supplies, or a fifth of what he asked for, which was incredibly constricting on what he could do, since he couldn't be anywhere near as aggressive. He was limited on food, ammo, and fuel for his mechanized anything mechanized, which disallowed him from being very aggressive. And instead, he had to be much more passive because he didn't have the supplies to be aggressive. And he would also lose a third of his supply ships from strafing, he lost a lot of supplies to just Malta alone. And the Germans decided that in order for them to be successful in North Africa, they would need to invade Malta in order to remove the very strategically important airfields located there. So they set out on a bombing campaign where they bombed the island for 154 days straight of continuous bombing, which left the destruction. It was a lot similar to the Blitz in Britain, though I think it was shorter than the Blitz. Mm-hmm. But the tactic was similar, of just destroy everything.
And to that point, just imagine like the mental turmoil that has on like the soldiers themselves, being constantly bombed all the time, having to deal with the conditions, and just the overall fear of everything, of war in general. Like these type of like heavy fire, like fighting itself, is just, keep in mind like the soldier's perspective and the amount of turmoil that the soldiers went through.
So after this stretch of bombing, Malta was short on supplies and very damaged. So the Allies in August of 1942, in order to help resupply, sent a massive convoy that contained 14 merchant ships, and the most important which being the SS Ohio, which was transporting 170,000 barrels of fuel to allow for all of the planes of Malta to continue to destroy supply lines. This was, along with that, they were escorted by two battleships, three aircraft carriers, and a handful of cruisers, destroyers, and submarines. And it was one of the largest, it was the largest escort for a convoy in the war so far. And it was immediately detected by the Germans, who needed to cut that off in order to have a successful invasion of Malta. However, they were not, well, they did sink 9 of the 14 merchant ships. The rest made it through, including the SS Ohio, which meant that Malta could still act as a jumping off, could still act as a convenient jumping off point for planes wanting to attack Axis supply lines in North Africa.
Yeah, and Malta is going to play a big role in the Mediterranean as a whole, as it holds out against German bombardment, and it bogs down the German convoys, and they have to avoid a whole area of water, and it gives a base of operation. And like you guys have said, I guess this is a couple times now, that the Germans are going to have a lot of trouble getting supplies from Europe to North Africa, and then especially once they get into North Africa, getting them to the front is going to be difficult. So, no, very good. And I know the next section we got is on technology.
Yes, and technology and just general statistics when it comes to the amount of like soldiers, tanks, yeah, and stuff yeah. like that. If we look at pure soldiers, they outnumbered the British about 2-1. But General Montgomery had commanded about 190,000 men, which came equipped with 1,000 tanks, 900 pieces of artillery, and 1,400 anti-tank guns. So that just puts it into a little bit of perspective how many people, how many soldiers he commanded, and how large his group of people was. And on the other hand, Rommel, who commanded about 116,000 German Italian soldiers, he also commanded 540 tanks, 500 pieces of artillery, and 490 tank guns. So that just puts into a little bit of perspective on the disparity between numbers of people and guns that were used through this. Now, a quote by Rommel states that the armor is the core of a motorized army. This is an interesting quote, in my opinion, because it provides this a point of people realizing how important mechanized units and how important technology was during the war. And so some of the, in my opinion, tanks were probably the most, as I've said before, probably the most important and deciding factor in this battle because of their ability to withstand fire and return it powerfully. So some of the tanks that were used were the M1340s, which were used by the Italians and were dubbed the Mobile Coffin because of how flimsy their armor was and how weak they were. And they were also seen to break down mid-battle because of, as Mr. Arvita said earlier, the overheating of the engines. I don't know who said it, but overheating of the engines, and they would just cause the breakdown. And they were pretty much dwarfed by the British Matilda tanks, as I said earlier. The Matilda tanks were equipped with a 2-pound turret gun that could hit. With a 2-pound turret gun and could hit a top speed of about 15 miles an hour, which doesn't seem too fast, but for a vehicle that size, it's all right. And it could withstand strong fire due to its 78 millimeter armor or an inch's three inch armor. Now, these were very effective in destroying the M1340s because of their weaker armor. And when the Germans came into this, they supplied the Italians with the superior Panzer III's and then later on Panzer IVs. Now, a little bit of statistics on the Panzer III's. The Panzer III's were able to hit a top speed of about 25 miles an hour. They had about 30 millimeter armor, which is about one inch, which is less than the Matilda, but it made up for that in its 50 millimeter guns, which is about 9.97 inches, and proved very deadly because of their ability to take down tanks. Now, Later in the battle, as I said, the Germans upgraded to the Panzer IVs, which were heavier than the 22-ton Panzer IIIs, with them being about 25 tons. It was used in fighting machine gun nests, infantry, and anti-tank guns, which it did with its the help of its 75 millimeter or almost 3-inch gun, which it had on the front. To help combat the German panzers, the British were outfitted with the M3 medium Grant tanks in about May of 1942. Now, the Grants used a 37 millimeter or almost 1.5-inch turret gun and a 75 millimeter gun with a bigger, which was mounted to the front of the tank, and it was in the hull, and they were very powerful, and these were also provided by the Americans, which I know we didn't say we'd mention the Americans, but they were meant, but the Americans gave us tanks in this battle, I don't really know what the word to use, but like as the successor, Sherman was the Grant. Now the Grant tank, it was very
the opposite. Because successor to the Grant was the Sherman.
Oh, my bad, my bad. Sorry.
Yeah, no, you're good. You're
sorry
good
about that. Sorry, one word. So the Sherman was heavier, weighing about 36 tons, and it had about 62 millimeters of armor, which is about almost 2.5 inches. Its top speed was 25 miles an hour, and had a 75 millimeter, almost 3-inch powerful gun. Now, planes, as I said, air superiority was very important because it gave you the ability to cancel out supply shipments, which crippled the Germans because, as we said before many times, the Germans were struggling to get supplies all throughout this battle. And now I'm going to pass it back on to my co-host Blade with Operation Torch.
I mean, I just wanted to bring up Torch as one of the results of the battle because
when I saw that on there, that's what I figured.
Yeah, I don't want to talk that much about the actual specifics of Torch, but
got a whole other podcast on that from season 3.
You go watch that.
Yeah.
But no, the success of El Alamein allowed for operations such as Torch, which let the Allies get a much better foothold in North Africa and allowed them to finally defeat the Germans there and finish out the campaign.
Yeah, and to Blade's point, like the story ends with Rommel retreating from Egypt across North Africa. And then in November of 1942, the Allies, led by the United States, are going to launch Operation Torch, which is a joint American and British operation, and it's the first like amphibious operations we have in Europe. And I like to point out too that time period, right? That November 8th, 1942, and then it ends in February or so, 1943. Mm-hmm. You're talking about a period of time where the Germans are going to lose Africa and be completely dislodged. Their best general, Rommel, he's out. And then if you go 1,000 miles north, they're losing at Stalingrad. And so the Germans in that same time period are losing, you know, Stalingrad is looked at as the big pivot point on the continent of Europe, but they're expelled from Africa. So this army that looked invincible at the start of El Alamein, right, with Rommel and everything else, is no longer, you know, this invincible thing. And you guys hit it, and Cody brought up the technology. The Americans are able to resupply the British with new technology, and then the British and American manufacturing is going to catch up, and the planes that come in are going to be what completely destroys Rommel's army. He cannot combat. Doesn't matter how many tanks he has, but if the British are able to, you know, strafe the tanks and strafe the convoys, he can't win. And that's what happens in North Africa, is the air control by the Allies ultimately does them in, and the supply control. But Rommel escapes, doesn't he? He escapes up, and they end up getting back to Europe, and he will meet the Allies on another day. But in this one, he does escape. So
yeah, and to that point, I would just want to talk about like the aftermath of the battle. So especially after you know, Rommel and his and German forces were on the run, we have a quote from British reporter John Pundy after the battle. And just to give you a little warning, the account is a little gruesome, but I think it's very important important to like realize the scope of the war. So it starts, below them stretched nothing but death and destruction to the very horizon. Shattered trucks, burnt and contorted tanks, blackened and tangled heaps of wreckage not to be recognized. They scattered the landscape as thickly as the stars in the sky. Like dead stalks in the sand, rifles were thrust upright in the nun forest. And each one meant a man who had been maimed or killed. In dugouts, a hand stretched out forth as if a supplication, or a pair of eyes stared up accusingly, and would stare so until they rotted into your skull. Here was a body with limbs torn from it or without a head, and somewhere else a head lay on its own, ripped apart bellies with a viscera swelling outwards like some great sea anemone, a throat impaled by a long shard of shells. These are details of scenes repeated again and again in every corner of the desert landscape, a great rubbish heap of metal and human flesh. So the victor sat, gazing across the gigantic desolation. So this quote not only shows that this was a bloody battle, but also a battle that left many just reveling afterwards with just the sheer amount of death and destruction that went from it. And so this is, I just wanted to just explain this a little bit more in detail about like how severe the battles were in this battle, and how pivotal of a point this battle was for the war effort, as well as just like the soldier experience.
Yeah, and the soldier experience is intense, and that's a great excerpt that you got there. The thing about the Battle of Alamein that I think a lot of people in the United States in particular, we don't hear about this one as much because it features the British and not the Americans. Operation Torch is even a footnote, I would imagine, in a U.S. history textbook. But these are the turning points of the war. Like, for D-Day to happen, for the invasion of France, these things had to happen first. And for the British, being able to solidify that supply line with the Suez Canal, and then eventually solidifying the Mediterranean, because that's the other big factor, is that we control the Mediterranean Sea at the end of this. It really is a pivotal point in the war. And like I said, it piggybacks right on top of Stalingrad. And so the Germans are losing, you know, in the Russian winter, and they're losing in the hot African sun. And so that's always the big thing, is that you get to 1943 and it seems like the victories are piling up for the Allies and the Axis powers are being defeated. And the invasion of Italy is going to happen, you know, a year later. So do you guys have any last comments or concerns? It's a good episode. So if anybody has any last things, I will start with Cody because Jaden just talked.
So I guess what I'll say is I'm going to end it off with saying, like, so in my opinion, this was one of the more interesting battles, in my opinion, to research, because it's not something, as you said, it wasn't something we really hear about because it wasn't like our big, it wasn't like a big American based battle. So it gives you like a new perspective on this, like a, as you said, big turning point. And I know I'm piggybacking off you a lot, but I'm just saying like it really does show just without this battle, with this battle, the outcome happened, what it led to, and it just shows the importance of this battle. And I found that to be a very interesting part in that. So,
thank you. All right, Mr. Blade.
Mostly what Cody said. I've also found it very interesting is that like this isn't very talked about. I don't think we talked about it at all in any U.S. history class that I've been in. So it was a very interesting opportunity to research a lesser known in the U.S. battle of the war, to learn a little more about it, especially for something so pivotal that doesn't really get mentioned.
Yeah, well said. I blame your U.S. history teacher.
Yeah.
What a horrible guy.
Yeah. Jaden.
I'm just glad to be here. And first of all, just relate the experiences of what I believe to be the Forgotten War, and to really be here to, like, with Cody and Blade and Mr. Arvides here, to really just show the soldiers' experience and actually reveal why this battle was so important.
All right. Well, very well said, Jaden. Guys, very good job. You obviously did your research, getting from a multitude of sources. Awesome job. And this was Tigers by the Fire signing out. Thank you for listening.